Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today on Labor Day, we'll examine the state of working and middle-class Americans who, for the last few decades, have seen the American dream recede out of reach for many, while a few wealthy families like the Waltons, the heir to the Walmart fortune, have seen their wealth grow to the extent that just one family has wealth equivalent to the combined total of the bottom 40% of all Americans. Dr. Harley Shaken, a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, who studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade, joins us. Then we will speak with Lawrence Michel, the president of the Economic Policy Institute and principal author of the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. We will discuss his latest report, Unions, Inequality, and Faltering Middle-Class Wages. Then finally, veteran labor journalist Sam Pizzagatti joins us. He is the editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and his most recent article is A Bold New Call for a Maximum Wage. We will discuss his proposal of tying the minimum wage to a maximum wage and how working and middle-class Americans can reverse the erosion of their standard of living and their share of the American pie. And joining us is Dr. Harley Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Harley Shaken.
It's very nice to be here.
And on this Labor Day, it's pretty clear that union membership is down and income inequality is up. And it seems to me that in the overall sense, as people celebrate labor and on this day, perhaps most people are thinking of the barbecue more than these political issues. But nevertheless, it seems to me a good time for us to reflect on the extent to which our economy has become a plutonomy and the extent to which our democracy is being captured by an oligarchy. Do you think that we have to start getting real in terms of where we stand, in the sense that it seems that it's about time we recognize that radical changes have happened here in this country, and this is not your father's America or your grandfather's America?
I think it's long overdue to make that recognition. We've seen this creep up on us, but the enormity of the inequality, of the decline for the middle class and of working families more generally, and of the decline of unions is really there. So it's not about time, it's way past time, and there's a great urgency. It's indisputable that union density, the percent of the workers who are in a union, has gone way down from almost a little over a third in the 1950s to a little under 12% today. And there's no question that we are experiencing record income inequality. What we failed to do as a society is bring these two things together. When unions were strong and a much more important part of the workforce, then we not only had record economic growth, let's say from the end of World War II to the mid to late 1970s, but we also had a much more equal society. Wealthy people certainly earned a lot more, but there were limits in part by the fact that you had unions representing not simply their own members, but the interests of working families more generally. The decline of unions is an important contributor to this growth of inequality, and this has very, very bad implications and direct impacts on families today.
And Harley Shaken, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office's office reported last year that the average household income for the nation's top 1% has more than tripled, while middle-class incomes grew by less than 40% between 1979 and 2007. And then you've had the Federal Reserve study indicating how the middle class has lost about 40% of wealth in the last decades. And then you've got the Pew Research Center coming out with a similar report. What does it take in terms of the public consciousness about the growing gap between our mythology of the American dream and the reality of how many people are being denied the American dream?
I think it takes focus and redefining the debate. The statistics are appalling and dramatic, but in a way we've heard them so many times that they seem to drift out of consciousness. Americans are feeling this in their homes, in their insecurity, in their apprehension about what the future might bring. So we feel it, but we place the blame for it for those who are not working or for those who have less than we have, but we view that we're being called to support. I think that's enormously misleading, and it deflects the attention from a vastly more unequal society, which in part is contributing to lower economic growth because the consumption that takes place when millions of working Americans are employed, their wages are increasing, they're buying things. So we are placing the blame in the wrong part, and we are looking at the solution as individual initiative. Of course that's important, but it is not enough to solve this growing gap, which doesn't exist in nature. It reflects policies that have been in place since the Reagan years.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Harley Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. Well, certainly the idea that it's all about the individual pulling him or herself up by the bootstraps is the refrain that we heard last week at the Republican convention. And there's a lot of people in this country, working Americans, the so-called Reagan Democrats, who, you know, have this aspirational notion that they too can become a millionaire. And of course, there's nothing wrong with the aspirational politics. But there seems to be an enormous denial amongst a lot of Americans about the value of a government. For example, we argue all the time, and the Republicans use this all the time, that we pay too much taxes. Well, we don't pay anything like the rest of the world. And the real argument should be, what do you get back for your taxes? And in other countries, in the social democracies, you get an enormous amount back. You get 6 weeks paid vacation. You get pregnancy leave. You get childcare. You get full health coverage. So my sense is that one of the reasons why American workers are so bad off compared to the rest of the industrial world is that simply they don't know about social democracy and how it works.
Oh, I think the way we frame the debate is profoundly misleading and certainly benefits those at the very top of the income scale, but completely distorts our politics. We've framed for decades now a debate between big government and less government. That's never been the appropriate debate. The appropriate debate is how we can have effective government. And what social democracy is all about is the balance between a market system where markets work and the role only a government can play for where markets don't work, and defining the rules of the game that allow markets to work. So one of the ironies here is the Republicans at their convention are recreating the sensibility of an America that existed in the 1950s, but that was an America of rapid economic growth, of families earning more and advancing the income scale, in part because we had strong unions and an effective government for highways, for schools, for research and development, all of which are areas that the present debate would like to downsize dramatically or turn over to the private sector. An additional irony at this very moment is with our hurricane devastating our southern coast once again, is this really the time to talk about less government? Who exactly built those levees after the last hurricane? Who is handling the rescue effort? This isn't an anomaly. This is an area where government is very necessary. And the notion of concentrating on effective government whatever the size is, and in some areas it means a much larger presence, in some areas perhaps a smaller presence, but to have the debate simply less government makes little sense in a complex, rapidly changing world.
Well, Harley Shaken, it seems to me that there's a great deal of cynicism in what's going on here, because one of the more peculiar speeches at last week's Republican convention was Chris Christie. And one of the things that he said, you know, that we, the Republicans, believe in individual initiative and pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, et cetera. But those Democrats under Obama, they want the government to coddle you. Now, the idea that the American government coddles American citizens is such a preposterous notion that if you really look at the record of where the money goes from people's tax dollars and what the government invests in, most of it's in the military-industrial complex, in agribusiness, and most of which you could argue is kind of right-wing welfare. The only traditional welfare that we have is Social Security, which incidentally pays for itself, and Medicare, which definitely needs reforming. But both of those programs are being attacked by the Republicans. I mean, it's just such a lie to say that the government is all about coddling people. If the average American realized what a bad deal we get compared to the rest of the world, they'd be outraged.
Oh, I very much think they would. And there's sort of a perverse irony that's going on here in last week's Republican convention. The fact that someone like Paul Ryan would pose as a champion of Medicare. If you follow the logic of his philosophy to its appropriate conclusion, you would say we don't need Medicare. Let the market handle it, and you pay for your insurance, and if you can't pay for it, you have an incentive to work harder. That's an argument very few Americans would buy, and because of that, you have someone like Congressman Ryan saying, I will defend Medicare. It's a little bit like Colonel Sanders saying, I will defend chickens. You think the track record isn't really there to do that. You can't have it both ways, and there are important elements of what government has done for working families from the New Deal onward, or even before the New Deal, that are very popular with Americans for the very pragmatic reason they work. Social Security, Medicare, the regulations that came out of the progressive era on food, on many of the other ways in which government plays a very positive role in ensuring that markets work.
Well, the rules for American capitalists, who incidentally are making out like bandits and have been for some time, we've seen from Mitt Romney's taxes, at least what little he's released, how much he pays basically capital gains taxes of 15% and less, and may well have paid less, and that we've seen that the enormous amounts of money that people on Wall Street have been accruing through a system of extracting wealth and concentrating it at the top, and not your old traditional form of American capitalism going back to the robber barons, where they actually produced products and provided jobs. And to me, the debate should be about the changing nature of our capitalism, because, you know, it's unsustainable in the long run to keep extracting wealth and not creating it.
It really is not sustainable in the long run. We have got an extraordinary country which has achieved some unprecedented things in a whole range of areas, but that's because we've had, at key points, effective government, and we've had markets that actually work. And you need both to have an effective market economy. And the fact that we have demonized government to such an extent, and the fact that we have the kind of inequality that we're seeing today, which isn't simply damaging economically, but undermines the very ability to have a democratic society. With vast gaps such as this, and with the ability to pour unlimited money into the political system, you have a very different country than many grew up with, and an impossibility of having the American dream in the way that we've historically known it when it has worked.
But we can look at specific events in history, in recent history, and see the examples of how and where and when we went wrong. For example, you were talking about earlier reforms going back to the Progressive Era. Let's just talk about the reforms that came in after the Great Depression, in particular the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment banks from banks. It meant that investment banks couldn't play with their depositors' money. Well, the lobbyist weighed in on Clinton, and he and his team decided, I think in part because the Democrats aren't getting the money that they used to get from the labor unions, because the labor unions have lost so much power and influence over the years, he decided to go after Wall Street money. I don't exactly know what was behind this appalling and apocalyptic decision, but they repealed the Glass-Steagall Act. And then, you know, a decade later, we saw the worst crash since the Great Depression, and we're still, you know, haven't come out from under it, and it may take another decade to even get back to where we were before 2008. So there you have a perfect example of how government can actually protect citizens, and if the lobbyists, because they got the money to buy the politicians, can buy the politicians to free up the hands, or, you know, take the handcuffs off the millionaires and put the handcuffs on the welfare queens, the old Reagan adage. All that propaganda was all inherent in the idea of releasing these creative forces of capitalism, and look what happened. I mean, it's all as clear as day to me.
Well, that what you described is a very damaging and dangerous cycle that we are still in the midst of. There's another dimension of this, which, you know, gets back to the very beginning of the conversation on inequality in strong unions. In the 1950s, when unions were near their peak and when we had enormously successful big business that was largely unionized, we learned an important lesson that highly profitable, successful firms that pay higher wages as a part of that create a virtuous circle. Firms are profitable, workers earn more, the flip side of their wages is buying more, and we have even more successful firms and a rapidly growing economy. This isn't theoretical. This is what happened from the end of World War II until the mid to late 1970s. There was a link, because of strong unions, between rising productivity in industry and rising wages, and all Americans benefited. We have broken that link. Unions are far smaller and weaker at the bargaining table, and the result is a new model that we've seen with Caterpillar Tractor in the last several weeks, where one of the most profitable manufacturing companies in the country that earned $5 billion, close to $5 billion last year, that raised its CEO's salary in many percentage points to $17 million a year, is asking for significant cuts to the wages of their workers, and establishing a pattern that we've seen in other areas as well, which is a profitable, successful company pays less. The problem with that is, if you generalize it, you're gutting purchasing power in the economy, and we have slow growth, and that's certainly painful for workers and their families, but it's also the undoing of the economic success that benefits corporations.
Well, Dr. Holly Shaken, I thank you so much for joining us here today on this Labor Day.
It's always nice to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Holly Shaken, who's a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Lawrence Michel, the president of the Economic Policy Institute.
There's power in the factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all stand.